Politics, Caroline Casey. So today has been proclaimed John Lewis Conjure Good Trouble Day. So we're going to honor him by hearing Morgan Freeman reading John Lewis's last words to us, dedicated vision, handing us the baton of liberating good trouble and dedicated vision. There we go. So, and then we will welcome Lucian Truscott IV, Perspicacious Prolific Scouting Reports. Lucian Truscott, .substack.com, many things, wrote conservative letters for the Village Voice, bringing his being sixth great-grandson of Thomas Jefferson and military heritage to the table of what shall we do now? So today, July 17th, is 400 cities will take to the streets, led by the 50501 movement, grassroots groups, invoking justice and equality. We'll tease and play with all those things. But welcome Lucian briefly, and then we're going to hear John Lewis. Hello, Lucian.
Hi. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. And glad you are game for conversing. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. So we're gonna hear Morgan Freeman reading John Lewis, and then we will meet on the other side of this. Thank you. Here we go.
While my time here has now come to an end, I want you to know that in the last days and hours of my life, you inspired me. You filled me with hope about the next chapter of the great American story when you used your power to make a difference in our society. Millions of people motivated simply by human compassion laid down the burdens of division. Around the country and the world, you set aside race, class, age, language, and nationality to demand respect for human dignity. That is why I had to visit Black Lives Matter Plaza in Washington, though I was admitted to the hospital the following day. I just had to see and feel it for myself, that after many years of silent witness, the truth is still marching on. Emmett Till was my George Floyd. He was my Rayshard Brooks, Sandra Bland, and Breonna Taylor. He was 14 when he was killed, and I was only 15 years old at the time. I will never, ever forget the moment when it became so clear that he could easily have been me. In those days, fear constrained us like an imaginary prison, and troubling thoughts of potential brutality committed for no understandable reason were the bars. Though I was surrounded by two loving parents, plenty of brothers, sisters, and cousins, their love could not protect me from the unholy oppression waiting just outside that family circle. Unchecked, unrestrained violence and government-sanctioned terror had the power to turn a simple stroll to the store for some Skittles or an innocent morning jog down a lonesome country road into a nightmare. If we are to survive as one unified nation, we must discover what so readily takes root in our hearts that could rob Mother Emanuel Church in South Carolina of her brightest and best, shoot unwitting concertgoers in Las Vegas, and choke to death the hopes and dreams of a gifted violinist like Elijah McClain. Like so many young people today, I was searching for a way out, or some might say a way in. And then I heard the voice of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. on an old radio. He was talking about the philosophy and discipline of nonviolence. He said we are all complicit when we tolerate injustice. He said it is not enough to say it will get better by and by. He said each of us has a moral obligation to stand up, speak up, and speak out. When you see something that is not right, you must say something. You must do something. Democracy is not a state. It is an act, and each generation must do its part to help build what we call the beloved community, a nation and world society at peace with itself. Ordinary people with extraordinary vision can redeem the soul of America by getting in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble. Voting and participating in the democratic process are key. The vote is the most powerful nonviolent change agent you have in a democratic society. You must use it because it is not guaranteed. You can lose it. You must also study and learn the lessons of history, because humanity has been involved in this soul-wrenching existential struggle for a very long time. People on every continent have stood in your shoes through decades and centuries before you. The truth does not change, and that is why the answers worked out long ago can help you find solutions to the challenges of our time. Continue to build union between movements stretching across the globe, because we must put away our willingness to profit from the exploitation of others. Though I may not be here with you, I urge you to answer the highest calling of your heart and stand up for what you truly believe. In my life, I have done all I can to demonstrate that the way of peace, the way of love and nonviolence, is the more excellent way. Now it is your turn to let freedom ring. When historians pick up their pens to write the story of the 21st century, let them say that it was your generation who laid down the heavy burdens of hate at last, and that peace finally triumphed over violence, aggression, and war. So I say to you, walk with the wind, brothers and sisters, and let the spirit of peace and the power of everlasting love be your guide.
Okay. Okay, Lishan Dreska, shall we set forth your perspicacious scouting report self, but also just to respond, if you have, to Morgan Freeden reading John Lewis's words, you know, the informed history of now, the revolutionary spirit. What are the dangers you would like us to be alert to? And what, from what John Lewis said, do you feel kindles a good trouble spark in your heart?
Well, I'm a great admirer of John Lewis, and of course, and I was a follower of civil rights history, what was going on in the civil rights movement pretty much from its earliest days. I grew up in the South on army posts, which meant that that I went to integrated schools, because President Truman integrated the military, the entire military, in 1948. So by the time I was going to schools, which was 1951 or two, the schools were on the army posts, the federal land of the army posts were integrated. But off the post, of course, was the segregated South. So I grew up in this kind of dual life of living with, being friends with, going to school with Black kids and all kinds of other kids on army posts, and then off the post was this other world that was very different and very disgusting. I mean, I'll never forget the first time. This is before I went to school. I was a little boy riding with my grandparents from Washington, D.C. out to their farm. And after my grandfather retired, out to their farm in Loudoun County, Virginia, which is just to the west of Washington. And it's now a bedroom community for Washington, D.C., and a very chic place with big mansions all over the place. But at that time, it was just farms. And we stopped at a little gas station on the way. I think it was in Leesburg. And there was a black and white water fountain, one for whites and one for blacks. And I remember asking my grandparents, you know, why is that? What is that? I'd never seen it before. And they sort of struggled to tell me, you know, what was going on in the state of Virginia in 1951. But when it comes to good trouble, I've been making good trouble my entire life.
Ah, I intuited correctly. Yeah. I think that's right. Wonderful. Yes. Say more. Good trouble.
It started out when I was at West Point, and they had a rule there, that they had a law there, a regulation they called it, requiring attendance at church.
Yes, I noted
for
that.
All cadets.
Yeah.
And it had been there, that rule, for 150 years. And you had a choice between the Protestant church, the Catholic church, or the Jewish services, which were held on Sunday, by the way. And that was it. If you were a Baptist or a Methodist and you wanted to attend one of those services, or Latter-day Saints, or not to mention Buddhist or anything like that, they wouldn't let you. You had to go to one of those three approved religious services. And in my senior year, a bunch of us were sitting around my room one afternoon in early September, right after all the summer training had ended. And this plebe came to the room and said, you had to sign up for your chapel squad, they called it. And so everybody was supposed to put down which service they went to. And I had, 2 years before, I was so grossed out by the Protestant chaplain there that I put down Jewish chapel service when I was a sophomore. And that was recognized by the powers that be as a change from the previous year when I was a Protestant. So I was 19 years old, and they told me I had to get my parents' permission to change my chapel preference. So I wrote to my father, and my father had gone to West Point as well, so he was aware of what was going on. And I said, I need a letter of permission from you to attend the Jewish services. So he gave me the letter. So I was attending Jewish services, but I looked carefully at the document that we were handed, and it stipulated that $6 was subtracted from our pay each semester for a mandatory chapel donation. So right there, four of us, me and three of my classmates, decided we didn't like that, and we were going to put in papers to be excused from mandatory chapel donation. So we did. And we handed them in, and we were all called up to the brigade command, the regimental commander's office, and basically told to withdraw our, you know, our requests. And we said, no, we wanted them to go through. So they went through, but only after this struggle over it. So that pissed us off so much, the next thing we did was hand in four letters saying we wanted to be excused from
right.
chapel
well,
service.
This is important to your heroic self, because the hero, the folk hero, is interested in liberating the entire community. Right? And you did, I noted that in your bio, going, oh, look, the rebellious, complex conversation, military, but great nuanced description that you give. You know, and then you had it, you had that rule, you composted that. So yes, good trouble, that sense of equality. When you were on Oprah in 1998, you know, you invited the descendants of Sally Hemings to the family reunion in 2000. They had not been, you know, allowed before, right? So So good trouble. And did they come? The article doesn't say if they showed up in
Yes, they.
2000.
Now that was 19. It was 98. I was on Oprah, and that was the first time I had met my cousins in the Hemmings family.
Right.
And so Oprah, after a the Oprah show was filmed live, and or live to tape. I can't remember which, but anyway. It was filmed in such a way that when they had an ad break, you just sat there and then the show started again. So there was an ad break, and right after the ad break, Oprah turned to me and she said, "Well, now that you've met all your cousins from the Hemmings family, what are you going to do, Lucia?" Well, I hadn't thought of what I was going to do. So I was put on the spot. I was sitting right next to her on the stage there, and I said, "Well, I think I'll invite all the cousins I have from the Hemmings family who want to come to the family reunion next May in 1999." And so I said, "You know, everyone was here. There were about 25 Hemmings family members there." Two of them were on the stage with me, and we were meeting my sister and me. And then the rest of them were in the audience right in front of the stage. And so Oprah said, "Oh, that's nice. You know, that'll be fun, you know." So that's what I did. And the following year, 1999, I arranged this elaborate thing to have all my Hemmings cousins admitted to the family reunion, which basically meant I just had to fill out a form, an attendance form for each one of them,
So,
and give
so, let, so,
$25.
so, so, let, so let's honor the all these parts of you. I mean, who brought what? We all need everything. What you bring to the table now, is so you are military heritage related to Thomas Jefferson. You're an Aries, incarnational agent of Mars. I will not burden you with the mythology, but I just want to bring a little bit up to play. We go, where's your Mars when you're born? You being an Aries. It's in Pisces, which has an impulse to all inclusive, right? Which isn't that right? Your hero's heart is intrinsically all inclusive, and to disrupt anything in the way of that. Is that a fair thing to say?
Well, you know, one of the people that interviewed me, I was interviewed hundreds of times when that happened in 99, from media outlets from everywhere, from all over the United States to Paris to Bangkok and Japan and China. And one of the people that interviewed me was the first black reporter for a television station in Washington, D.C. And she asked me, "Why?" And I said, "What?" And she said, Why are you doing this?" And I realized at that moment I hadn't thought about it. I had not thought through and come up with, like, I had invited him. I said, "You know, I invited him on the Oprah show." And she said, "But why?" And I said, my mother had died the previous year. And I said, "Because if I didn't do this, my mother would have me by the short hairs."
Yeah, excellent.
Well, the lady from the TV station in Washington started crying, and she stopped the camera. And she cried, just bawled, and she had to redo her makeup, and she said, "I've been waiting to hear something like that my entire life." And
Okay.
so all of a sudden I had this feeling like, you know, something that I had sort of thrown out on the Oprah show was coming true now, and it was a very big deal, especially to black people. And But I also realized that's the way I was raised. And my mother, my father and my mother raised me that way. My mother was the one I sort of got my spelled out values, if you could call them that, specifically from my mother. And
so we want to honor your mother and all of those all-inclusive teachings and really tease it into now and why, you know, what shall we brew and encourage? You know, and so I've read your Substack, LucianTruscott.substack.com, you know, and to distill, you know, I think one of your recent ones is a few words about the war and the power of determination, about, you know, in Afghanistan, this village, you know, repeatedly, but the will, the dedication to come back. And that was something you're invoking, you know, into now too, right? This power of dedication. And then we can go to all your articles on Epstein and why that's important and all of those things. But the power of determination.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was walking the dog the other day. And I knew I wanted to write something about it, about the war in Ukraine. And the image of that destroyed village in Afghanistan was right near the border with Pakistan, popped into my head. And also the image of the little rebuilt village about a half a mile away. And I thought that shows such incredible determination that these people in the face of one war after another, you know, Afghanistan just got hit with one war after another. And the war with the Americans there was just another war. And what they had done was, when they got something destroyed, then they rebuilt. And then I realized that's what's going to happen in Ukraine. That's what happened in Vietnam after we left Vietnam. That's what people do when someone comes into their country and says, no, you're doing this all wrong. We're going to tell you what to do from here on out. And so I sat down and wrote this article about determination and how important that is with, you know, in these wars that are fought all the time, everywhere. You know, I look every once in a while, there's a website that basically has a counter for how many wars that are going on at any given moment. The last time I looked, there were 45 wars around the world going on. So, you know, war is something that human beings do.
Well, that's a longer conversation, but let me pitch something to you from the mythic news at the moment. So each part of the sky choreography has a metaphor. The image for Pluto right now is deserter from the military following their own wilderness path, a return of conscience, following conscience. So that's a very specific image. This is an old tradition in this language. But do you see, you know, again, military people are quitting ICE, right? I mean, isn't this something that you, in a sense, call for in your investigations too, which is for people to follow their conscience inside the military, inside everywhere, right? Yes.
Of course, it can be very, very difficult to do though, because if you stand up and, I mean, I got in so much trouble for that chapel thing at West Point that it followed me into the Army, and I lasted less than a year in the Army.
But we're calling on John Lewis, who says, yes, it's hard. Now it's your turn, he said to all of us, to let freedom ring. You know, walk with the wind, brothers and sisters. You know, be outspoken. Well, you're being very outspoken, Lucian Truscott. You're incredibly prolific. You know, I just learned of you recently, you know, on Substack, and it's like, oh, there, every day you're publishing something. It's very wonderful. You know, and again, that dedication to a moral obligation to speak up, you know, John Lewis says, you know, can redeem the soul of America, you know, good trouble. So you're still stirring good trouble. And, you know, you've also been quite emphatic about you know, well, you said put a double prison guard on Ghislaine Maxwell. She knows more about that than anyone about Epstein and Trump, and he knows it. And you pointing out, like, there's a lot of opinions, but that this is a really important story, like dedication, accountability is the sine qua non for democracy, right? So is that part of your ardent dedication to these stories, or to the Epstein story, that accountability is essential in everywhere and here too?
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing this for 54 years. When I worked at the Village Voice, a lot of the things that I wrote were about city politics and corruption and in the various administrations that there were in New York City. And I covered the Watergate story. I covered the Bebe Rebozo end of the Watergate story. And of course, that was attempting to bring Richard Nixon to account for his crimes that he committed in Watergate. You know, it's, I think it's the obligation that you have to be a citizen, to be a full citizen of a country. And I, you know, it's my ability to write has given me a way to express it, you know, to express myself and to put my ideas out there and hope that people read what I have to write and are inspired or follow along and do things that are similar on their own.
Yes. Yeah, and I think we have a rousing break music song that we've played before by Ephronius Henderson on No Kings, because you've also been, you know, very much calling for, yeah, as you say, well, the craft of being a good citizen. And on the other side of the break music, I want to converse with you about, you know, you are self-described conservative, you know, and wrote conservative letters at the Village Voice. And, you know, it's like, well, and what are those qualities? We'll bring that up on the other side of the song, you know. And I do love a conservative friend years ago, when I just met, what do you know about the writings of about how the conversation about big government, small government is irrelevant, because what Edmund Burke was saying is the more we cultivate the art of being good citizens, the fewer outer rules and regulations we need. And I think that's a worthy conversation to have, right, Lucian Truscott?
Well, I have to tell you that I don't describe myself as a conservative any longer.
Right.
My conservative letters written to the Village Voice were written in 1966 and 67. So I sort of changed my spots over that Chapel case at West Point. That's what changed things for me.
That's great. Yes, you're a questing, deep delving, challenging kind of person, and so you feel, are you feeling kinship with the No Kings movement arising as an intelligence in the community? Maybe. Are you still there? Oops. Oh, did we lose Lucian? I don't know. Did we lose? Oh, it. We will go to the music. We were waiting because we're used to his pauses, but there he goes. We'll go to the music. Ephronius Henderson. We played it before, but it's such a great anthem. It's the No Kings anthem. Here we go.
They cut the cords that held us close,
but we still stand.
They fired folks. They broke their oaths,
but we still stand.
Stripped the aid, took the care, cut the lights, said life ain't fair.
We still here, we still rise. Ain't no king above our lives.
They try to write our freedom out the law books, erase our names, our pride, and our looks. But we're the heartbeat under every street, and we won't bow, we won't retreat. No king,
no king,
no crown.
To sit down.
We rise up.
We rise.
job. To every brother denied the care. To every grandma without her meds.
We still care. We still care.
To the ones they fired from the bed. Cut off dreams, left justice dead. You are not alone. You are not erased. We bring your memory into this space. We ain't marching just for show. We march for every no. For every door that's slammed in pain.
We open wide and rise again.
No king.
No king.
No king.
No lord.
No lord.
No chains. No chains and hold our course.
We free.
We free. Now we bow the toll.
We the people, truth and light. Marching through the longest night. No kings, no fear. Just us, we here.
No kings, no fear. We rise, we hear. No kings, no fear. This march, this year.
Woof, that is No Kings by FNS Henderson. We've played it before as break music. It's just such a great rousing anthem. We want to see the streets filled with that. And we rejoin our John Lewis Conjure Good Trouble Day with our perfect for now guest, absolutely Lucian Truscott IV, perspicacious, prolific scouting reports, luciantruscott.substack.com. Wrote conservative letters for the Village Voice, but clarified right before the break, he no longer refers to himself as a conservative. He's free range, always changing his mind, a great thing that he brings. So, yes, welcome back, Lucian. I'm glad you rejoined us here. And, you know, I will say, just for the mythological fun, you know, I do have your astrological chart, and you have a configuration in it called Thor's hammer, which is the capacity to swoosh corruption out of the halls of governance. And today in our guiding chart, we have a Thor's hammer. So just, we don't have to believe anything, but isn't that a wonderful idea that in your magic backpack, you have a Thor's hammer to sweep corruption out of the halls of governance? Would you like to do such a thing?
I've been doing it for quite a long time.
Excellent. Thank you. All right. Yeah, well, you've been doing it since birth, right? Which is a great thing. And so your exhortation. Well, say more about how, you know, for all of us to be effective in sweeping corruption out of the halls of governance or the church or anything. We're all deserters from orthodoxy following conscience, Well, let me toss one more thing. Well, do you remember the wonderful movie 7 Days in May, long ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, Fletcher Knebel, JFK's favorite movie until he died. But remember, it's a coup against democracy. But there comes a point where there are members of the who just can't. I can't go that far. Do you feel that where there's a point where, you know, just can't do it, desert from the corrupt thing? Is that a tide that you encourage, that you've been working on for 50 years, but how about now?
Well, you know, I don't think that we've seen the level of corruption that's going on right now, but also in the first administration ever in this country.
Right.
The amount of pure personal corruption that he's involved in with crypto and all of this crap that he sells and gold sneakers and then these meme coins and all the rest of it. I mean, it would have been impossible for me to even conceive of that 10 years ago. The idea that a president of the United States be hawking Bibles out of the Oval Office is just, you know, you can't, you listen to the stuff that you, yeah, that you read in that.
I was just going to say, and bullying his way on stage with the World Cup winners, you know, and people are like, how did this guy get on stage? And that he actually had stolen the actual World Cup and given them an imitation. Anyway, yeah, just the cheesy, cruel carnage, corruption is true, unprecedented. So
amazing to think of. It's amazing to think of. I think that there must be something in him that where he can't stop himself. It's astounding. But you know, I mean, the job that I have with my Substack column is, I guess, to chronicle it all. I mean, lately I've been writing about the Epstein files and all of that, but it's it's so overwhelming that sometimes, like last night, I didn't write a column because I couldn't. I was just felt overwhelmed.
Yes,
you know? This is a brand new thing for the United States, but I think that it's been in the American people to accept this kind of corruption and this kind of incredibly immoral person forever. I mean, look at our history. Look at the way we took this land from the Indians and then we enslaved Black people for several hundred years before the Civil War. And, you know, it's, you know, these things stick with you. They're, at this point, it's in our genetic makeup. You know, the lost cause thing in the South is baked into that culture down there. And at this point, it's baked into the human beings that live there. It's astounding.
Well, and it is, you know, as Lewis says, withdrawing our complicity, you know, and as you just laid forth, you know, again, revelation, complicity, everything up to be resolved right now. And, you know, I think the metaphor of possession by Trump is useful because it's the cabal around him, and it is a kind of nightmare of the most grotesque, you know, crude, vulgar forms of, you know, American evil. But in this, you know, and the complicity, because it is, you know, it is the Opus Dei, it is the right wing part of the Catholic Church. It's Steve Bannon, who is a trained kind of practitioner of, you know, visualizing things into being. It's the tech bros. So it's the oligarchy inquisition that we've, as a country, have outsourced our leadership to. And I think in your calling, you know, to be a citizen, yeah, so for each person, for, you know, all of us who insource our authority, you know, and dedicate to what is it to be a good citizen, I want to toss that back to you, you know, we suck the energy or the chi out of outer authoritarianism. So there is community, there is citizenship, you know, and to you, you know, yes, 50 years of dedicated swooshing corruption out of the halls of governance, you know, what is your, let's see, what are the qualities of being a good citizen that you have gleaned that you might like to, in, you know, spiral forth to encourage us?
Well, I think being informed is the first duty.
Yes.
Jefferson said, of course, that given a choice between a government and a press, he would take the press. And he very much believed that the citizens of a country needed to be informed about what's going on. And we, in this country, we have the press, we have the internet, we have television news. Now we have podcasts and all that kind of stuff. And, I think that the duty of being a good citizen is to read or watch or try all of it. You know, it's a mistake, I think, to stay in what they now call our personal silos of curated information. You know, it's important to read conservative points of view as well as liberal points of view, and even stick your toe into the waters of the crazy every once in a while to see what they're up to, the QAnon types, you know. But you let that stuff distill in you and figure out what you believe and then from there what you're going to do about it. I mean, it should affect your vote. It should affect decisions that you make about the way you live your life. And I've never been much of an activist. I've never been involved in putting together a rally or a march or anything like that. I mean, what I've always done is write, and and people read what I write, and I hope they read what other people write, and then they take all of that stuff and distill it down and decide what they think about things.
Let me toss this back to you. So we know that, you know, polls and that the huge proportion of Americans hate the cruelty of ICE. That's like, no, we don't. I mean, like huge percentage, you know. And so it is time for crossing borders. And then what you bring up, and, you know, the Epstein and all, is the feeling of betrayal. Well, fairy tales often begin with betrayal, because betrayal can be a huge force, you know, of like, whoa, of, you know, spellbreaking. It can be hoovered up by another cult, but also spellbreaking, going, whoa. And you yourself, as somebody who rejoices in learning and changing your mind, right? It is a wonderful thing to change mind. It's like, oh, I used to think that, and now I think something different. It's like the best. And that, you know, being circulated in the world. But so what do you think about, you know, as you're exploring the Maxwell, Epstein, everything, the power of a populace betrayed can be a powerful liberating force if it's invited in?
Well, I wouldn't think it, I wouldn't exactly use the word liberating. It's a clarifying force. That's what I think is happening to Trump's, what they call Trump's base and his true believers. I think a lot of them are now experiencing what you and I and probably many of the listeners have experienced for 10 years, which is the experience of being lied to. I don't think many of these people thought that the words and the things coming out of Trump's mouth and what he does were immoral or were lies. And now all of a sudden they can see, all the stuff that was said to them during his attempts to get elected three times. A lot of it was lies, especially this stuff about Epstein and the Democratic cabal to round up little children or whatever. It's right. Craziness.
Well,
it's
so part of
recognizable to you and me as craziness, but to these people that don't read anything but They just listen to podcasts, or they pay attention to Steve Bannon or whatever, or they just listen to Trump on Fox News. You know,
yes,
this
but
is
part of our good trouble. Part of our good trouble is we're hurling liberating lightning at the spiral, you know, to set it free, because there is all that you say. But I'm feeling, seeing, we're encouraging, especially today, well, onward forever. You know, again, what I meant by the liberating power of betrayal is that it's an opportunity to change one's mind, like, oh, wait a minute, I thought this, it can be hoodwinked again, but again, that idea of like, welcome all awakening and possibly even liberating, you know, and when you mentioned, you know, the night before or last night when it was just too overwhelming to write your prolific contribution on Substack, and that's available, you know, in sort of psychic cable download, panic, anxiety, overwhelm, to everyone who's aspiring to participate and put things out, like, and then, but here you are, plucky again, and here we are, plucky again, you know, filled with John Lewis's words, walk with the wind, and we go, all right, back up. It's like, I think it was after the second George W. Bush election, I was just on the floor, like, oh God, and had radio, here we are team to do, and a wonderful friend, trickster friend called up and goes, no, if we're not having fun, we're just not serious enough. I'm like, oh, I needed that. All right, up we go for the sake of the team. You know, the good prophet in the Bible, Jeremiah, saying, you know, speak to the weary a word that will rouse them. And we go, yes, this is good. So are you up for your reporting, Lucian Druskett, and you're also encouraging. Do you speak to the weary a word that will rouse them? Yeah, you do.
Well, I hope it does. You know.
Yeah.
I hope it does. I mean, my feeling has always been, if you provide people with enough information, they can seize the information and act on it. I think that's the you know, that's sort of my operating theory. And it's what I do is gather information and tell you or tell people what I think about it. You know, it's, I don't think I could have done this 20 years ago. It's taken me to get this far along in my life to where I can look at these things that are going on in the world and really start to sort of understand or partially understand what's happening here. And that's the fun of it to me, is discovering. I mean, yesterday, the day before yesterday, when I was walking the dog, and that image of that village in Afghanistan popped into my head, you know, that's the fun of it, to be reminded of things you've seen and things you've done and things you've heard, and then let that stuff come in and affect what you're doing now and what you're thinking now. It's, you know, that is a life, I think, that is, let's say, more fully lived than if you just amble along and don't take in new information and don't think things over. So that's fun for me. It's fun for me to sit down in the evening and try to figure out what I think about what's gone on that day in the news, you know. So,
yeah. Well, what about now? I mean, what do you think is? I know you've written about the Epstein story. The Epstein story is a big deal. You capitalized over the last 3 days. You've been trying to steer yourself away from it. But what do you think? I mean, it is important, you know, and that sense of revelation and accountability, and that, you know, may everything be revealed, like the sketchy, many things, many visible, but many horribly hidden, you know, Trump's done, you know, the assassination attempt after he had this great conversation with Orban, who's a big fan of staged assassination attempts. Anyway, may it all come out. May it all come out. You know, as a fervent wish. May you know, and that's part of you're part of a team of revelation, right? The acuity, and as you said, it's fun. So what are your thoughts now, ongoing? I mean, having written so much about the Epstein story, it's a big deal. What are your current thoughts on that?
On Epstein?
Yeah, sure. Or the client list, or you know.
Well, I read a thing yesterday about where Chris Hedges interviewed the guy that published the Epstein Black Book. I think it was back in 2015. He got it from one of the prosecutors in Epstein's first prosecution in 2008. They gathered evidence when they were prosecuting him for what he got convicted of was a minor count of prostitution, soliciting for prostitution. But they came up with the Black Book, and this guy that Chris Hedges interviewed listed the names in the Epstein book. And it's like a who's who of powerful people in this country, Democrats and Republicans both, and people whose political leanings I don't even know or care about, just rich people. And it really makes you wonder what's going on that these people could basically become followers of this guy. And I guess it had to do with their sexual appetites, although there is no evidence that everybody in the Epstein Black Book partook, as you might say. We don't have any evidence of that. But why would they even be friends with the guy? Why would they get on his jet and fly to his Caribbean island? Why would they visit his ranch in New Mexico? You know, it's another thing that's so astounding that in the common turn of phrase, you can't wrap your head around it.
Right. Well, it is a cult, and it is a crucial lesson before America and never, you know, to distinguish a cult is the toxic mimic of community. Cult is tyrannical, you know, and it is this very kinky, corrupt, you know, quality. And it goes back to just many, what do we encourage? You know, Skull and Bones in Yale was, you know, they did black magic rituals. The sense of empathy is weakness, and I kill it in me now. And it's like, well, we will give you, you know, financial and political power. Then, you know, and Elon Musk saying empathy is weakness, and it's a cult that is mistaking the whole point of life, really. You know, and you as an empathic fellow, going empathy is kinship and freedom and a good thing and a good quality. You know, and but it has been exiled. So this is all a pertinent nightmare. You know, that we're covering. You're covering again. Our guest is Lucian Truscott IV, august military ancestry, brings a lot of cultivation to the table, and you can find him on Substack as well. So we're in our final minutes, but thank you for being game, and thank you for your always learning and scouting reports and changing of mind. And is there anything you would like to wish for good trouble upon the our experiment in democracy?
Well, I was flat out floored by how effective the No Kings demonstrations were. My experience with demonstrations goes back to the moratorium and against the war in Vietnam. And in fact, I became good friends with Sam Brown and David Mixner, who were the organizers of that. But in this case, I think that the No Kings demonstrations were functionally and physically bigger than the Mausoleum ever was.
And, huge.
And I live in a small town in northeast Pennsylvania, and the turnout here was astounding. The town only has, the village only has 1,000 residents, and there were more than 1,000 people on the street. Of course, they came from surrounding areas and everything. But and it was so peaceful, and there was no violence in any of the demonstrations, and that really had an effect on people. That's part of how part of it's the power and effectiveness of those demonstrations. I think that we need a lot more of that. We're going to need a lot more of that going into the 2026 election.
Yes, a lot. And thank you for exhorting exactly that. We are dedicated to such things. Yes, bringing up more. Well, yeah, and what you said, No Kings, you know, my small gathering outside D.C. was just citizens, and the intelligence of good citizens arising. Yeah, exactly as you say. And that is it's a rising aroused, and that is good trouble. So thank you all, team. Thank you so much, Lucian Truscott, for being game. Thank you always, Kirsten Thomas. I'm Caroline Casey. You can find Visionary Activist Show on Patreon, and we will reconvene next week. Woof, woof, woof.
Oh, yeah, dear.